Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte, despite what you may see out your window today, Charlotte and all of Western North Carolina is in a drought. And as the absence of rain until this morning has helped dry things out, we've begun to experience wildfires. North Carolina's mountains have been stricken with several such fires to the point where Governor Cooper recently declared a state of emergency, and the state has instituted several burn bans until the risk of fire subsides. But when might that happen? And will forest wildfires become the new normal in our state as they have in the West, in Canada, and elsewhere? To help us understand the drought and how climate change is impacting weather in the region, Brad Panovich rejoins us. He is the chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV. Welcome back, Brad. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You're welcome. And to help us get a clearer picture of the fires that have been raging in the western part of the state, we've invited Jimmy Dotson to be with us. He is Natural Resources Manager for North Carolina State Parks. Jimmy, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Kevin Harville is a regional forester for the North Carolina Forest Service, Region 2. He served as incident commander for the recent Poplar Drive fire in western North Carolina. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. And David Borax, WFAE's climate reporter, is also with us again this morning.
Hello, David, Mike.
Back. Good to see you. Brad, I'm starting with you. I know it's raining this morning, and we've heard that the rain's not going to make a dent in the drought, but how much rain have we had so far today since midnight?
In the Charlotte area, generally about 3/4 of an inch, which is good news because it's only 9 o'clock, and we've got a whole day of more rain, and it's been a nice steady rain. So right now, as of this minute, that's the most rain since early October. And if we go over an inch, that will be the first calendar day with an inch of rain since late August. So It's been a while. We have not seen a day like this in almost 3 months. It's been a long time.
And I'm not a meteorologist, but I can tell you why it's raining this morning. Do you want to know why?
What's that?
We're doing a show on the drought. No, we're doing a show on the drought. That's why.
Yeah, either do that or you schedule a NASCAR event. That seems to be one of the ways to get rainfall.
So and don't forget the old wash your car trick.
That's right. So I've got, when I found out there was a drought in North Carolina, it kind of snuck up on me. It surprised me because my impression is that we got a lot of rain at the beginning of the year, and I thought we were okay. When did signs of drought begin to slip in?
Really, right when the calendar flipped to September, it was pretty dramatic because one of the things that happened late summer and early fall, as you know, we typically get some type of tropical entity, right? A decaying tropical storm, maybe even a tropical storm or a hurricane, or the remnants of one that merges one of these fall cold fronts. Well, we had a very active hurricane season, but none of those storms really impacted the Carolinas. So without that, those tropical systems and their associated moisture make up about 25% of our annual rainfall here in the Southeast. So when you don't get those and you're going into the fall season, you get a little worried because this is typically a drier time of the year already. And the fact that we didn't get that, and then we saw this persistent high pressure kind of park over the Southeast, and that pattern starts showing itself in early September. And then you got really worried, like, wow, this doesn't look like a 1 or 2 week thing. This could be a long-term problem going well into the fall.
So what constitutes a drought? How do you define it? What's the official definition?
Well, it's really interesting. I think a lot of people it seems easy to say, oh, it's rainfall. It's really not just rainfall. That's kind of the main thing that we can measure, but it really comes back to impacts. And one of those is wildfires. It's stream flows, reservoir levels, groundwater. And one of the big ones is agricultural. If there's a big impact on, let's say, grasslands or pastures, or the farmers are having trouble with their crops, these indicators will put us in drought, even if the rainfall is there. So that's why you can get into a drought real quickly. If you don't get about an inch of rain every week or so, you start having a deficit with a lot of the vegetation. And so every week that goes by that you don't get that inch of rain, you have the vegetation trying to draw moisture out of the ground. You've got evaporation rates. And we also got to remember that it's been a very warm fall too. So the fact that we've had mid-80s in early November and October, that drives the evaporation rates and really dries things out. So it's a combination of things. It'd be easy just to say rainfall. It's not the only metric we look at. We look at a lot of different things.
So I know that Mecklenburg County is in a stage one drought. I'll get you to explain what stage one is, but I looked at a map yesterday and it appears that from just to the east of Mecklenburg, then all the way to the west, pretty much the whole state is colored yellow on this map, which I'm assuming is stage one. And then along the South Carolina border, there are some counties where it's red, which means I guess they're in severe drought. Where are we in Mecklenburg today, and who else is in this stage one, and where is it worse?
So we're actually considered severe drought in Mecklenburg County, but you mentioned those areas along the North South Carolina border, which are in extreme drought. And one of the things that's really impacted this drought compared to others is just not the lack of rainfall around Charlotte. Remember, the Catawba River chain is our main source of drinking water, right? All of our beautiful lakes along the Catawba chain, that's really where we get a lot of our moisture. Well, if you go upstream into the eastern facing slopes, areas of the North Carolina mountains where they typically get, you know, 80, 90 inches of rainfall per year, those areas have actually seen less rain than us. So the headwaters of most of our tributaries to the Catawba chain have seen less rainfall. So that's really affected the lake levels, which then that moves downstream into the Piedmont of the Carolinas. And so the fact that we've seen a lot of lack of rain up there and a lack of rain here is kind of combined together. So the whole western part of the state is either in severe or in moderate drought conditions. And that is really because of that lack of rainfall. And just to put it in perspective, we can look at how much rain it would take to end the drought. You know, currently we here in Charlotte, we are in what's called Climate Division 5. We need 7 inches of rain over 30 days to end the drought. But in the mountains, you're looking at anywhere from as little as 8.5 to almost 11 inches of rain over a 30-day period to end the drought. So when we see this rain today and people go, oh, that's it, you know, we're not going to get anything remotely close to that today to end the drought. We need that over the next 30 days.
So Kevin Harville's with us. He's regional forester with the North Carolina Forest Service Region 2. And one of the reasons we're talking about to all of you people today is not just the drought, but what the drought has done in the mountains in terms of wildfires that have broken out in various different places for weeks now. What is the situation this morning, right now? How many wildfires are underway?
Sure. So the rain has helped us a lot over the last couple of days. There were some showers up in the mountains a day or two ago. We have one large wildfire going on right now, and that's the Sourtown Mountain Fire in Stokes County. It's currently 700 plus acres and 0% containment on it.
And last week, the Forest Service reported that the Collet, if that's how you say it, Collet Ridge Fire in Cherokee County near Andrews had grown to 5,000 acres or more, while the East Fork Fire closest to Western Carolina University's campus had been contained at just over 300 acres. Where do those fires stand today? Are they both out, under control?
They're not out. We still have resources cooperating with the U.S. Forest Service on the Collet Ridge Fire, as well as the Black Bear Fire, which is the one that's off of I-40. And those fires were doing what's called repair and rehab. We're fixing the areas where we had the bulldozers and the hand crews put lines in and making sure that there's no erosion issues and that sort of thing, kind of cleaning up the mess that we make when we fight a wildfire.
And what has been the damage to forested acreage and or property like homes or businesses or campsites, I mean, or campgrounds, et cetera, as a result of these fires?
Sure, sure. So, you know, fortunately, Collet Ridge and Black Bear, there wasn't the damage. The Poplar Drive fire that I was on, which is 100% contained, we did unfortunately lose one primary residence, a couple of cabins and some outbuildings. So that is the real property damage. Then, of course, there's the environmental damage where the fires go through and it burns the trees and the underbrush. And we really won't know the extent of that damage until next spring when we can see what leafs out, what comes back.
And Jimmy Dotson's here from the North Carolina Parks. At some point in recent weeks, the parks closed certain areas of parks scattered around the state, particularly in the mountains. Where does that stand today?
So most of the North Carolina state parks have been open and operating as normal. The biggest thing that we implemented was along the lines of the campfires in accordance with the state burn ban. Kevin and the Forest Service have the primary responsibility of responding to fire, wildfire from a suppression standpoint. And we try and assist them and comply with the necessary measures across the state.
Despite the rain today, things are dry, and the intersection of drought and fire were among the topics discussed by the 5th National Climate Assessment, which came out last Tuesday. It's a check-in required by Congress every 4 years. And North Carolina State climatologist Kathy Dello helped write the chapter about the Southeast.
We're seeing now in the Southeast both drought and fire impacts. It's been very dry here in the past few months, and we're seeing fires in the Appalachian Mountains. And we cover this in our chapter, that there is a link between drought and fire, especially in our shoulder seasons, which we call spring and fall. And we're expecting this to continue in the future. We see more instances of what we call flash drought in the Southeast than any other region of the country, which means we can dry out pretty rapidly, even if we've seen a lot of rain like we did in the beginning of the year.
So, Brad, we know the Earth is warming. Last year was the warmest on record, according to scientists around the globe. We know climate change has led to devastating wildfires in the western part of this country and in Canada and in other parts of the world, in fact. And in recent weeks, we've seen brush fires pop up in this area just west of I-77 and, of course, wildfires erupting in our mountains. Is this drought and are these fires the result of climate change, or simply a dry spell in our weather?
Well, I mean, individual events are always hard to tag to climate change, but you see a trend in these extremes. And that's really what we're seeing here in the Carolinas. You go from a super wet spring to these flash droughts. And when you heard the state climatologist talk about these flash droughts, it's like a flash flood, but in reverse. It's where you rapidly dry out in short periods of time. And it seems like in the autumn in particular, we're getting a lot of these flash droughts, which is one of our fire seasons. We have fire season in the spring and one in the fall, obviously when you have dormant or dead or dying vegetation already. And those are dry, windy times of the year. And so when you get these flash droughts during these time periods, you tend to see a big uptick in wildfires. So we're seeing a lot of these extremes, and it's an increase in the frequency and intensity of these droughts and these wet periods. It's not just one or the other. It seems to be, you don't just get stable rain anymore. It either is a ton of rain or none at all. And that's really where you get into some problems with climate change, these massive extremes and swings from season to season.
David Borax, our climate reporter, is here. David?
Yeah, Mike. So Kathy Dello's comment there about this does prompt us to ask about whether this is related to climate change. And Brad's right. It's hard to attribute individual events, although we are developing a capability that they call it attribution science, where they take a look at normals and they compare what happened in a particular weather event, and then they can say with more certainty these days that something was related. We don't know. We don't have this these kinds of reports done for any of these fires that we're talking about here, but the trend of warming temperatures in North Carolina is going to continue, and we know that warmer temperatures do lead to, evaporation and make the ground drier, and they do create this. I would say the best thing that we can say about this is that climate change is making events like these more likely these days.
So when we come back, I want to talk about that and about whether or not the evidence of that, which is clear on the face of it, is changing attitudes, because there has been over the years, as you know, as our climate reporter at WFAE, David, there has been political pushback against this idea. We'll come back and talk about that and how you respond to wildfires and more in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the drought and the wildfires that have come from this up in the mountains of North Carolina. And we are in a drought here in Mecklenburg County and have been for a while. We're talking about it with Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV. Jimmy Dotson is the natural resource manager for the state parks. And Kevin Harrell is a regional forester for the North Carolina Forest Service Region 2. We're going to talk about how you fight forest fires in a moment or two. And David Borax joins us. He's WFAE's climate reporter. And you've been reporting on the climate and various aspects of climate and how to protect us from or slow down climate change or react to climate change now for a very long time. And there have been over time, particularly in this state and other places as well, David, as you know, obstacles erected that would prevent us from taking action more quickly than perhaps we could have in some of these areas, much of it motivated by politics. Well, now that we can really no longer deny the impact, the fact that the climate is warming, that there is an impact to it that hits the coastal areas with rising sea levels and flooding and soaking longer-lasting rains that result in frequent flooding. And then, of course, the impact of a lack of rain on parts of the state, including our western mountains and the forest fires that are a result. Are attitudes changing?
That's a great question, Mike. And I would say over the past 5-6 years since I've been covering climate change seriously, things have been changing. And it's now true that about nearly 3/4 of Americans of all political backgrounds think that climate change is happening. And most of those believe that humans and human activity are the cause. That comes from a poll that's conducted regularly by Yale University and George Mason University, and I follow that pretty closely. More recently, they have asked people about how their experience with the effects of climate change affects their views, and not surprisingly, the more experience you have with fires, flooding, hurricanes, and that sort of thing, the more likely you are to accept this idea. But it's no longer a question of do you believe in climate change? It's now a discussion about how we respond to it, and that gets complicated as well.
Jimmy, you are with the North Carolina Department of, Natural Resources, but you're the state parks natural resources manager, and that the fact that we have state parks and that we put money towards state parks indicates that they're important in the state, and they're important to our political leaders in the state. You're facing problems now because of climate change, and that means that some of your resources that you might have put towards something else have to go toward the impact of climate change. Is that being acknowledged at a policymaking level?
That's a good question, Mike. In reality, I think that more and more folks along the lines of what David was inferring are starting to acknowledge it. So it makes it an easier conversation than it has been in the past. A lot of policies in the past weren't necessarily oriented towards even considering the aspects of climatology. It's funny, you asked earlier, were these wildfires related to drought? And from a science standpoint, one of the things that we've been able to look at in the last 10 to 15 years more frequently is the study of dendrochronology, so tree ring science. There's a lot of evidence based on how wide those tree rings grow related to rainfall versus drought as to whether or not trees have adequate resources to grow a certain way. And then if a fire event occurs during that ring, you can begin to correlate the trend of inadequate rainfall to higher fire frequency.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a challenge in the Southeast compared to places out West, because most of our trees are not 400, 500, 600 years old in our dry upland areas because the U.S. has been settled for so long in the East. But there are still some remnant areas that have those indications. Realistically, our best information really only comes from the last like 100 years or 200 years in terms of fire frequency that's recorded in tree rings, because a lot of the East has been settled.
There have always been wildfires, Brad. There have always been droughts. NASA says that we face a drier future, and that sets the stage for, I guess, more wildfires. That appears to be what we are experiencing here, because we see wildfires now. We hear about them on the news all the time, and I don't recall that happening 20 years ago. Have we moved into an era where droughts will usually be accompanied by these wildfires? Has that always been the case? Is this the new normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think these extremes are definitely something we're going to have to get used to. And I think the other thing that we found out, especially this summer, is how we're connected to other parts of the world. I mean, when we had all the wildfire smoke from the Canadian wildfires move down here, and we had some of the worst air quality in Charlotte since the early years I got to Charlotte, when we had ozone action days all the time. That air quality issue was because of these massive wildfires, record-breaking wildfire season up in Canada, where you have vast areas of that country which are uninhabitable, and it's not even feasible to fight those fires, right? Because they're in areas where just winter is going to have to come. And to see that smoke move down here and people actually realize, like, wow, we're being impacted with poor air quality from fires on the other side of the continent, I think really makes people realize how important these the other parts of the world are to our weather, climate, and air quality here. So yeah, I think in the future, I mean, in the Southeast, you know, Jimmy makes a good point. We have unique challenges here because of the density of our population. There's a much more human interface with the forest here because there's more people living in and around. So you've got this double whammy. If we get into a situation like a flash drought like this year, and we have people doing outdoor activity and recreating in this dried out forest, you have the opportunity for more fires to occur. So I think that's something that a lot more folks, especially as the mountains become more developed and more people move there, that this is something they have to take into account, that that's part of living in this part of the country is going to be wildfire.
Which leads me to this question, Kevin. We've had these wildfires of late in the mountains. Are they caught? And wildfires can start for any number of reasons. Were the ones that we've been talking about and reading about in the paper and seeing on television, have they been caused primarily by human activity, carelessness, burning leaves and things getting out of control? Have they been caused by lightning strikes? Have they been caused just because everything is so tinder dry and wind blows and the sun heats the atmosphere? What's the cause?
So in North Carolina, about 98% of our fires are human caused. So 98% are preventable. The notable exception of the current wildfires is the Collet Ridge fire with the U.S. Forest Service out in Clay and Cherokee counties. And that one was a lightning strike fire. But going back to what Brad was saying, according to the U.S. Forest Service and a University of Madison, Wisconsin study, North Carolina is number one in what we call the wildland urban interface. So just what he said, folks moving in, putting their house in the middle of what was once a patch of woods, makes it that much more challenging for the structural firefighters and my wildland firefighters to get in there and save property and do it all safely.
Go ahead, David.
It actually also causes another issue, which is that one of the best ways for us to prevent wildfires, and you guys can talk more about this, is by controlled burns or prescribed burns. And as more people move into that urban wildland interface, it makes those logistically more difficult. And as we were talking earlier about the effects of climate change, likewise, climate change is making it the number of fire danger days higher, which means the number of days that you could do one of these prescribed burns is falling, and that is creating another issue.
There are two state burn bans in effect at the moment, or at least there was last week. We have 100 counties in North Carolina. 30 of them are involved in these burn bans. Essentially, for our listeners, those bans cover Mecklenburg County and Iredell counties and everything to the west, up to the north, up to the Virginia state line and down to the South Carolina state line. What do these burn bans impact? What do they restrict? Kevin.
So there's two separate types of burn bans. So it's important for your listeners to know the difference. The first one is the state-issued burn ban, which is issued by the Commissioner of Agriculture. And that impacts outdoor burning further than 100 feet from an occupied structure. So anything out in the wildland, agriculture burning, that sort of thing. And then each individual fire marshal in each county has jurisdiction within the 100 feet of those occupied structures. So it's important for folks to know who issued the burn ban, because it impacts where they can and can't do their activities.
And Brad, we have a question from Andrew about climate change and about hurricanes, because they say that they thought climate change would bring more extremes in hurricane season. We really haven't had a lot of hurricane activity in this area this year. Had we, would we be talking about drought? Would we be talking about wildfires? Or would have the drenching rains from hurricanes taken care of that for us?
Well, the funny thing about hurricanes is, you know, there was a lot of systems this year where, you know, we got down to the V's, right, and the letters. The problem is the steering currents. You know, where do the storms go? When we get those seasonal forecasts, I think people often think, oh, it's going to be a, I hear this a lot, it's going to be a bad season. Well, it's not a bad season unless they all hit you, right? The season is all going to be dictated by where these storms go. What happened is we've seen this persistent southeast ridge, which is a persistent high pressure system. Typically, that is over Bermuda, and it kind of steers moisture from the Atlantic and these tropical systems into the southeast. It's the reason many of our areas near the South and North Carolina border end up getting a ton of rain, because they get constant upslope of tropical air. But this year, that ridge was kind of parked on us. It was right over the top of us, which kept us dry and steered everything around the southeast. So it really wasn't so much about the number or intensity of the tropical storms or hurricanes this year. It was all about that steering current being in the wrong spot. That big cog in a wheel in the atmosphere at high pressure was not in this typical location. It was more centered over us. And because of that, it was very dry, but we should also say it was very warm. We're going to have a top 20 warmest autumn on record here.
Is that a factor of climate change, or is that just the vagaries of what happens in the systems that produce weather?
If it was a one-off, you could say, okay, it's just another year, but we're seeing it more persistently. We're seeing consistently warmer summers, falls, and winters. I mean, it's hard to argue when you see the trends in that. And when you get warmer air this time of year, it just drives up those evaporation rates. And it really causes things to dry out even quicker than they normally would. We already have dry air, and it's typically windy. But temperatures usually in the 60s and 70s, not the mid 80s, like we had so often this fall already.
So, Kevin, the North Carolina Forest Service publishes a ton of information about wildfires on its website. You track fire statistics from 1928 to the present. And although the number of wildfires is increasing over time, when I look at those statistics, it appears that the peak was between 1979 and 1982. We've been well below that peak for several years now. And in terms of the number of acres of forest land destroyed by wildfires, the peak arrived in the early 1940s and has been declining ever since. So what can we extrapolate from that as we talk about drought and wildfires this morning?
Well, there's a couple of things. We're getting better at what we do. Folks have cell phones. Folks travel around, so we're getting fires reported in a more timely manner, so we're able to react to those quickly. What really I like to focus on is the last 5 or 10 years. And, you know, we're looking at 2016 or fiscal year 17 for state government. That was kind of a notable year. That's when we had all the western wildfires in North Carolina. That's when Gatlinburg burned and that sort of thing. And then this year, because of the drought, the severe drought that's set up in places, this fall trended in that same direction as that last notable year of 2016. But North Carolina, it ebbs and flows. It's, you know, El Nino, La Nina patterns have an impact, where that high pressure sets up, time of year that all that sets up. This wouldn't, for my guys that are out there, if this happened in late August when the leaves were still on the trees, it would have been, you know, bad, but not as bad. the fact that it's set up right at leaf fall, and we would have to go back and continually day after day after day go back and blow leaves out of the lines, or else the fires might rekindle and get back out. So that takes a lot of labor and a lot of time to keep up with them, just because of the time of year that everything's set up.
Jimmy, I didn't realize this until I looked at these statistics from the Forest Service, but we have, and this might surprise people, we have wildfires, sometimes numerous wildfires, every single day in this state. We lose acres of forest with many, if not most, of those fires. Has that always been the case?
That's pretty much been the case since humans have been on North America, Mike.
We've
had fires over the history for centuries.
Wow.
We've just more recently been recording them. And as Kevin said, the reporting from the fact that people have access to quick turnaround sources of information, cell phones, text messages, we get the reports faster than traditional.
So I've, because of these recent fires and over the years, back when I was a child, there was Smokey the Bear, who was on television all the time. I think Willard Scott, the meteorologist, actually Jackson Weaver from Hardin and Weaver at a radio station in Washington, was the original voice of Smokey the Bear. And he said, only you can prevent forest fires. And it all made us think that forest fires are a bad thing. They aren't a bad thing. They're part of the natural restoration of the forest. But they do have an impact, a negative impact on us. So how do you balance that equation, Jimmy?
Yeah, so in reality, fires themselves are not a good thing or a bad thing. It's how you're looking at them. So if they're burning down somebody's house, bad thing. If they're burning down somebody's high-value timber stand, bad thing. But a lot of our natural systems that we enjoy in state parks and wildlife resources, game lands, and across our national parks and forests are actually fairly adapted to fire. Like over the centuries, the species have become accustomed to periodic fire. They've grown thicker bark. They've developed certain ways to produce seed or disperse seed. They flower. Some plants only flower if you burn them, or if they're burned naturally at a given point in the year. And then some wildlife species depend on fire as well.
When we come back, we're going to talk about how we fight these fires and the fact that humans are responsible for most of them. And we'll talk about that as well with David Borax, Jimmy Dotson, Kevin Harville, and Brad Panovich. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here, WFAE's climate reporter. Brad Panovich from WCNC-TV, where he is the chief meteorologist. We're talking about drought, and we're also talking about wildfires that have started because of this drought. That's why Jimmy Dotson is with us, the Natural Resources Manager for State Parks, and Kevin Harrell, Regional Forester with the North Carolina Forest Service Region 2. And Kevin, I understand that about 90% of wildfires in recent years have been caused by humans. Lightning strikes play a role. We had But in 2022, we had 6,222 fires that burned 28,851 acres, and of those, 99% were caused by humans. Do we need to change the way we interact with the forests now that climate change has become a factor? Are we being careless, or do we just not understand the impact of climate change on our activities?
So when you dig into those human-caused fires, the majority of those are accidental, what we classify as accidental. There are some of the arson set, the intentional, the incendiary fires. Some are careless, but the most are accidental, whether it's machine use, somebody mowing the grass and they run over a rock and spark the grass on fire, or they thought they put their campfire out, but it wasn't completely put out. So what we need folks to do is take the care and the time when they're in the forest to make sure that they're not going to cause harm by carelessly throwing a cigarette down or accidentally leaving their campfire smoldering when they pack up and go home for the day.
And Brad, Climate Central reports that the North Carolina Northern Piedmont had 19 fire weather days last year and now has an average of 13 more days of fire weather than just 50 years ago. That was 1970, by the way, just in case people have lost track of time. The Central Coastal Plain now averages 10 more days of fire weather. The Southern Coastal Plain, 8 additional days of fire weather. And these days are appearing in spring and in winter. Is there any reason to anticipate that this trend will reverse?
I don't think so, because of all the seasons that are warming around here, it's our cool season that is warming dramatically. So, you know, you're seeing days in December, February, even March, where you have really warm, windy, dry conditions. Because you got to remember, the cool season, which is, you know, fall, winter, and early spring, is typically when we have the lowest dew points, the lowest relative humidities, and we have a lot of wind. The jet stream's right over us in the wintertime, so we get a lot of windy days. Well, if you have a warm day coupled with that, then that leads to these high fire danger days. And that's really the weather aspect. And then on top of that, if the fuel sources, which is the dry vegetation, is there as well, that's unfortunately the perfect storm for wildfires, when you have the weather component, but also the dry fuels or overabundance of fuels combined on the same day. And that often happens in the cool season because it's not the growing season, right? The vegetation's dormant. It's dead. It's dried out already naturally. And so that's where I get worried, is that we see those fire days more in the time of year when things aren't green and growing. And that's what leads to these more extensive fire days. And, you know, we were talking about 2016 earlier, and, you know, you remember the Gatlinburg fire and what a firestorm that turned into, because we had one of those fall cold fronts coming in with, you know, 70, 80 mile an hour winds on top of a wildfire. And that's what you worry about this time of year, the combination of those strong winds and the dormant vegetation.
Kevin, we normally think of wildfires as happening exclusively in highly forested, remote areas like the mountains of California or the mountains of North Carolina, et cetera, although people do live there now. But is it possible, because we're fairly heavily forested in Mecklenburg County and the county surrounding us, for us to have wildfires right here?
Absolutely. My region, which is the Piedmont region of North Carolina, we have the most wildfires as far as number of fires in the state. So the majority of the fires, not surprising to you or this panel or your listeners, it follows where the population is. If the majority are human caused, the majority of fires are going to be where the humans are.
So we have all seen on television people, particularly with CAL FIRE, fighting forest fires that are raging beyond control and destroying communities, et cetera. And it looks like a almost impossible effort to control these. Pictures, however, cannot possibly capture what you guys who fight these fires go through. So what is it like on the ground?
Well, firefighting hasn't changed since the Forest Service was born, whether it's the U.S. Forest Service in the early 1900s or the North Carolina Forest Service in 1915. We work to either make the heat cooler, so put water on the fire, or we remove the fuel by hand or with machines. So that part hasn't changed. But what has changed is the technology that we use. So using bulldozers where we can. So a lot of what we're doing either on the Poplar Drive fire that we mentioned earlier up in outside of Hendersonville, or the Sourtown Mountain fire, or any of them in the West, you know, our primary tool is a bulldozer. So we'll go in and create that fuel break to try to remove the fuel, take the leaves and the litter and the sticks away from what the fire is burning. If that doesn't work, then we go back to the old way, and we'll have hand crews of folks with shovels and rakes and pickaxes to go in and put it out. And that is hard, dirty, thankless work that, it takes days to do. And, you get in and get sweaty and you get covered in soot.
And when you say that a fire that's been raging for a while is now 50% or 30% or even 100% contained, what does that mean? What do those numbers mean?
Sure. So when we attach a percentage to a fire for containment, that means that a certain section of that fire, we are confident that if we were to walk away from it, that it's very unlikely that it's going to come back to life and get out of containment and cause us to come back and have to put new lines in.
And what tells you that? What gives you the confidence to say that?
So we have what we call our operations folks. They're the ground pounders, the ones that are out there actually digging the line. So they are the ones that come back to me as incident commander and say, we are confident that we have mopped up, we have put out all the hot spots, that this line, this road, this ridge line, this rock face is going to hold and the fire can't escape here.
And Jimmy, you're with the parks, but I'm told that at certain fires in recent days, you sent some personnel to assist in these recent fires. How unusual is that for the Parks Department to get involved in fighting fires?
Mike, a lot of our employees are actually certified wildland firefighters. And our role in the state is to assist the Forest Service when needed. With the number of vacancies that a lot of the state agencies have had, the fact that we have qualified people to be able to help in the field when Kevin and the other Forest Service folks request assistance is a benefit not just to them, but to the general public as a state agency. We had one of my staff on the Colette Ridge Fire, helping the U.S. Forest Service and the North Carolina Forest Service in the operation there early on. And we've sent at least one 20-person crew to assist in the past few weeks, along with several other individuals just in different logistical aspects.
Kevin, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just any one agency. It's state parks helping. It's the Wildlife Commission, emergency management, local volunteer fire departments. We could not do it by ourselves. We've brought in 150 folks from Western states, from Oregon, Washington, too many to name, in this fall to help us.
Climate change is costing us money. The fact that things are getting warmer, things are flooding, insurance rates have gone up for people along the coast. If you can get insurance, I'm sure the same thing is happening in fire-prone areas. How much does it cost us to fight these wildfires? And has the cost increased as evidence of climate change has become more prevalent, Kevin?
Well, I'm certainly not the climate change expert, but as far as cost for the fires this fall, we're well over $2 million in paid out cost. So that you mentioned the governor's state of emergency, I believe, earlier, and he recently expanded that last night to cover additional counties east of I-77. So the governor doing his state of emergency opens up some of the rainy day funds for us right to be able to cover those costs.
David, I don't know if you know the answer to that question or not, but as you've covered climate over the years, I'm sure costs have been rising, and you know about some of those. Do you know what these more frequent and more widespread wildfires are costing us?
As far as North Carolina or the Carolinas goes, I don't have a number, but okay. I could just confirm that, you know, as these the number of fires and the temperatures rise and all that, we can expect those to go up. We do know that more broadly, the number of billion-dollar disasters in the U.S. every year is going up, and it used to be one every 4 months in the U.S., and now it's one every 3 weeks, and that's a combination of factors. One is, cleaning up after these fires and repairing things is more expensive than it was in the 80s, but it's also true that we have more of them, so, big damages.
Jimmy, the U.S. Forest Service issued a report last year outlining their national prescribed fire resource mobilization strategy, which highlights the importance of prescribed fire as a management tool to reduce wildfire risk to communities, critical infrastructure, and cultural and natural resources. That's a quote from their report. And they say they are taking steps to improve their prescribed fire program. Do we have a program like that? And are we taking steps to change it in light of climate change?
We have several prescribed fire approaches within the state. to try and address some of that. But the Southeast has long been a stronghold for prescribed fire. So while the rest of the country over the last 100 years has kind of really bought into the Smokey the Bear aspect of the messaging, the Southeastern states, as you would expect, are a little stubborn and rebellious. And so people continue to burn because their grandparents had taught them how to burn. Their great-grandparents had passed that tradition along. One of the things recently that has been published is the North Carolina Prescribed Fire Needs Assessment. It was conducted by UNC Wilmington, which starts to put kind of a frame of reference of how much land do we have, how much are we burning prescribed fire in a proactive manner compared to what do we actually need to be trying to get to.
Sometimes these prescribed fires have gotten out of control. It happened in New Mexico, which resulted in the largest blaze in New Mexico's recorded history. I'm just curious why we do them. Why are they necessary? We have bulldozers, as I think Kevin mentioned earlier. Can't we clear underbrush and dried buildup of leaves and pine needles that way? Why is burning the best way to do this? Or is it the best way to do this?
It's one of the most cost-efficient. Prescribed fire compared to wildfire costs dramatically less. I mean, some people will see a big prescribed fire and say, well, you had 75 people there, and I saw bulldozers and hand crews and a helicopter flying for that prescribed fire event. But in reality, that's pennies on the dollar compared to what the wildfire itself costs. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say that wildfires, fires of any kind, whether they're wildfires or prescribed burns, result in smoke. And we know that the smoke can move, and it does move with the prevailing winds, and it can blanket large areas of our country, as the Canadian wildfires did to much of the east coast of the United States. Pollution levels have smoke contains damaging particles. David, you're the climate and environmental reporter. What is happening to our environment? Our air, we've cleaned up our air pretty well over the last several years. Now these wildfires come in and kind of wreck things. What's the impact of that?
Well, we mentioned earlier the National Climate Assessment, and one of the three main points of this year's report was that climate change is bad for health. And key among that in recent years has been wildfire smoke. The other ones are rising heat and the health effects of heat. And then things like tick-borne diseases and insect-borne diseases are also on the rise.
These fires produce smoke, which has particulate matter in them. And Sean Taylor with the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality talks about the impact of that.
Pollutant that we're concerned about when we talk about smoke is what we call particulate matter, which just means small particles. Smoke has a lot of what we call fine particulate matter, these really tiny particles. It's defined as 2.5 microns or smaller in diameter. That's 30 times smaller than the width of a human hair. And you can imagine when you breathe in smoke and you breathe in all of that fine particulate matter, it can get really deep in your lungs, or it can penetrate deep into your respiratory system and even get into your bloodstream.
And those recent fires that we've been going through in the mountains brought those 2.5 micron levels into the atmosphere. Are there long-term health implications to that, or is it simply during the fire and during the smoke cover?
I would say the biggest issue there during the fires and afterwards is people who have underlying health conditions and who maybe they have heart conditions, they have lung conditions, and when this factor is added, it actually hits them hardest. And you know, as far as longer term issues with that, I mean, it affects people's health. It probably contributes to an increase in deaths, and it certainly costs us more.
So I have 45 seconds left, Brad, and we had a wet start to this year, which is why this drought is such a surprise to me, at least, and maybe to others as well. What do you and your meteorologist colleagues have to say about what to expect in the next couple of months during the winter?
Well, I mean, the good news is we've got El Nino setting up, which typically for the Southeast means wet and cool winters. We haven't seen that track set up, that storm track. Maybe the rain today is kind of the precursor to that storm track setting up, where we get a system every 2, 3, 4 days. And during an El Nino winter, there's really good evidence that we're going to see above average precipitation. We may not be as cool as some people would like. The snow lovers out there think, you know, this is going to mean a snowy winter. It's got to be more than zero, which we had last year. For the first time in recorded history, in Charlotte's history, we had a winter with zero snow. I don't think that'll happen this year.
So I want to ask you about our prospects for a white Christmas. Brad Panovich from WCNC, Jimmy Dotson from the Park System, Kevin Harville from the Forest Service. Thank you all.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.